Well, John, let's begin with the origins of this effort to use the Bible, use Jesus as a weapon. Does it go back to the Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell? Does it go back to Nixon and his attempts to reach out to what he called the silent majority? Or does it go back even further in our history?
I mean, I would technically take it back to the Roman Empire taking over Jesus's operation. I mean, no joke. Like, that was when it really stopped being the movement of this homeless Jewish carpenter visiting the poor neighborhoods of Galilee. And that's when it became an imperial power. That's when Christianity stopped from being an oppressed sect to being an imperial religion that could oppress lots of smaller religions. That's when Christianity began persecuting and killing pagans, slaughtering Jews along with Muslims in the Crusades, and where they began to have this evil rationalization that's continued for centuries, which is we can violate all the teachings of Jesus as long as we force Jesus on other people. If we force slaves to be Christian, if we force the Indians to be Christian, it won't matter that we killed off the slaves and the Indians. And that's what we see to this day. People are willing to go ahead and violate everything Christ said, but they're doing it because they care so much about Christ. It's all about power. I would say the Roman Empire is when Jesus's movement stopped from being a ministry to the less fortunate and became about earthly power and using Christ as a figure for earthly power. I mean, I don't see our right-wing friends really fighting that hard for the poor and sick right now. I see them fighting very hard for conservative Christian cultural domination.
Yeah, and in terms of this modern iteration of it, certainly power and about control, and particularly control over women.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, always. And again, that's, to me, very anti-Jesus. The Hebrew scriptures, look, 2,000 years ago, women had it rough. I mean, they were property. A wedding was a pact between two men, the bride's father and the groom's father. And women had no inheritance rights. Some women had money because they were married to wealthy men. Those women financed Jesus's movement. I had never been told that wealthy women financed. They were the EPs of Jesus's whole operation. But women were unclean in the eyes of God. Menstrual blood, which gives life to humanity, was deemed as something foul and offensive. And so if a woman gave birth, she was unclean. If it was a female baby, she was unclean for twice as long. If you touched something a menstruating woman had sat on, you were now unclean in the eyes of God. Now, some will say that there were hygienic reasons for these laws, but you can't deny it's led to thousands of years of weaponizing women's bodies against them to make them feel inferior because of how God made them. Then you got Jesus showing up, and he breaks all the taboos, right? Like, he treats women as equals. There are women in his ministry. There's three women that go everywhere with Jesus and the 12, but the men who wrote it decided there were not 15 apostles. There were 12 apostles and three groupies. The women are the first people Jesus appears to when he returns. They financed his ministry. And Jesus's whole operation is about overturning the laws of his own religion. He teaches women, which was strictly forbidden. He tells Martha, when she's mad that he's teaching Mary and she's doing the housework, he essentially tells her education is more important than doing housework, which is a revolutionary thing to say to women 2,000 years ago in any part of the world. When the bleeding woman touches him, she'd been bleeding for 12 years. Sam Cooke wrote a great song about it. And she thought if she touched the hem of his garment, her bleeding might stop. This woman broke every law of her religion by going out in public. She made everyone in the crowd unclean in the eyes of God. She made Jesus unclean in the eyes of God by touching him. He turns around, calls her daughter, the only time he calls anybody daughter in the entire Bible, and says, you're healed. She breaks the taboo, and Jesus destroys the taboo for good. It's incredible that misogynists think they follow this guy. And then Jesus dies. Paul comes back. Paul takes over, I should say, and misogyny's back on the menu. All of the stuff about women being second-class citizens, being subservient to men, being in submission to men, that's in the New Testament, 100% of that does not come from Jesus. Most of it comes from Paul, who our right-wing friends need to be reminded is not Jesus or God.
In the book, you also write about Mary Magdalene and this whole construct that she was a prostitute, that's an interpretation and a somewhat more modern one than the Bible itself.
Yeah, I think it's Pope Gregory who decided that there's that famous story where Jesus is having dinner with his friend Simon the Pharisee, because Jesus did hang with some of the Pharisees. They didn't all hate him, and he may have been one himself. And the woman comes in and is weeping and weeping and weeping and washing his feet with her tears. And Simon's all like, oh, man, if you knew what this chick had done, you would not be seen with her, man. This lady's nasty. And Jesus doesn't really care about humiliating the woman. He can tell she feels bad. And he says to Simon, do you see this woman? It's one of the best parts in the Bible. Like, do you see this woman? Like, she's crying. She feels so bad about how she's been slut-shamed by this world. We don't know what it was she did, right? Jesus doesn't really give a damn about embarrassing her with specifics. He says, you're good, lady. You're forgiven. You're awesome. Go ahead and go. And Jesus says to Simon, you know, the people who think they're forgiven, very often not the case. Pope Gregory decided that woman was Mary Magdalene and that she was crying because she was a prostitute or some unnamed sexual sin. And so it's stuck. And movies have reinforced this throughout the years. But as you well know, the Bible never calls Mary Magdalene a prostitute. Instead, she was one of the women who financed his misery, his ministry, one of the first people he showed up to when he returned. In the Bible, he meets her because he drives demons out of her. He has a side gig as an exorcist. And of course, people have speculated over the years in musicals and Dan Brown books that he might have been married to her. So it would make a lot of sense why the church would try to silence her influence. I mean, anyway, you look at it, this woman was an apostle, and she has been smeared with sexual shame for 2,000 years, deliberately, by dead guys.
And I don't want to be judgmental here, but I don't think it's unusual that the same people who would fall for evangelicals and the charismatic preachers would also succumb to the influences of somebody like a Donald Trump. Now, is that because they are prone to looking to leaders like that and perhaps following a man more than following the word of God, or is it because they have the same end goals in mind?
I think it's just like the history of a fundamentalist Christianity. It's never about the teachings of Jesus. It's always about power. They don't really care about the teachings of Jesus. He commands individuals and nations to care for the poor and sick and to welcome the stranger and to be kind to those in prison. Jesus overturns the death penalty and tells you to love your enemies. Are you getting any Turning Point USA vibes off of any of this yet? They don't care about the teachings of Jesus or the commandments of Jesus. They care about conservative Christian power. Fundamentalists believe not that they're better than you, but that God thinks they're better than you in all religions. And that's why fundamentalists deep down know that they're the ones who should be in charge. They should be setting policy, you know, for God. And this is what's ruining Islam, ruining Judaism, ruining Christianity. It's not atheism. Atheists aren't driving people away from the churches, and it ain't Jesus or God or Moses or Santa Claus. It's the intolerant Christians who care about control more than they care about the ways Jesus told us we should treat each other. That is what is killing Christianity in America. That's why it was 90% in the 90s. It's down to 65% now. And for the first time, we're at a place where less than half of Americans worship on the regular in this country. They're not turned off because of spirituality. People still have a spiritual hunger. They're turned off because of meanness.
Yeah, and I like what you said in the book, organized religion and individual spirituality are not the same.
Yeah. I mean, they're not, you know, there's, and I'm not against organized religion at all. I mean, so much good has been done in the name of organized religion over the years. We don't hear about the good deeds done by kind Christians, Jews, and Muslims. And we don't hear about the groovy Christians, Jews, and Muslims who are getting along right now all over the world. It's the violent douchebags who get all the headlines and get all the ink and get the news. But at the end of the day, it's about you and the commander in chief, right? If there is a God, it's really about he or she or it or they or whatever pronoun and you. And God's many unauthorized fan clubs can do a lot of good. They can do a lot of destruction. But individual spirituality is what it's all about. Religion is, you know, there's a lot of good things it does. But I think your viewers really know the history of authoritarian religion and all the suffering it can produce. And that's why in the book I talk about throughout history, every time authoritarian Christianity has violated the teachings of Jesus for power, it's always been the Jesus followers who fight back. The Crusades, they're slaughtering people. For Jesus, though, who commanded us to never hurt anybody, and we're killing people for him, Saint Francis quits the war and preaches peace and walks unarmed through war zones to arrange meetings between Crusaders and Muslims. You got the Doctrine of Discovery and Columbus, and the Pope says go around the world and steal resources and rape native populations, but force Christianity on them. So Columbus is here slaughtering people in the shadow of the cross, and it was the Catholic priest on his boat, Bartolomeo de las Casas, who was the first white person to officially protest these abuses in this hemisphere, wrote to the Queen. Like, you look at slavery. Christianity propped up slavery. I go into the book about the verses they used to justify it, and it's the Jesus followers. It's Frederick Douglass and the Quakers and Harriet Tubman who fight back. In the Holocaust, they're slaughtering Jews, and you got Christ followers like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who martyred himself for people from a different religion, which a lot of people today in this country wouldn't understand too well. And then segregation, propped up by Christianity, and it's a Baptist minister out of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Dr. King, shaming white America with these same scriptures. And again, they did it for power, but they ignored and rejected the actual teachings of Jesus. That's homophobia. That's exploitation of workers. Every time you've seen authoritarian Christianity being cruel and exploited in the name of greed, it's always been the Christ followers and their allies of other religions and non-believers who've always pushed back against the batshit Christians.
We're talking with John Fugelsang about his new book, Separation of Church and Hate. And we talked with you last time about faith versus certainty and those people on the right who are certain that they know the answer and have the truth. And we saw that just this week when a guest on Fox News went after the Pope because the Pope dared to suggest that maybe it was inconsistent to call yourself pro-life but be in favor of the death penalty.
Yeah, I would have gone farther than the Pope. Because here's what I'll say. If you want to put people in jail for abortion, which Jesus never mentioned because you're so deeply Christian, but you want governments to keep on murdering prisoners, which Jesus actually opposes, then the rest of us aren't obliged to take your claims of piety seriously. I mean, I'm at a point where I'm saying on there, why should people who've read the Gospels believe that our right-wing MAGA friends care about the actual teachings of Jesus? Fundamentalism does this across the boards. And I don't think the opposite of faith is doubt or disbelief. I think the opposite of faith is certainty. And these fundamentalists know, they don't believe, they know God likes them better. They are certain of it to their bones. And that's why they're usually the bad guys in most religious stories throughout the ages. That's very different. If God wanted anybody smited, he'd smite them himself. So apparently, he seems to want us to get along. That seems to be what all the world's religions keep telling us. But the fundamentalists of all the world's religions keep getting the wheel. So to me, anyone who's searching for the truth, I'll listen to. Anyone who's claiming they own it, I generally don't trust.
I made the mistake of wandering into a conversation with someone on social media, and she threw out the Bible is the word of God excuse. So, what's the best response to give those people?
The Bible is, if the Bible's the word of God, then God does not want us to ever see any original copies of any original text. God doesn't want us to know what the original writers put down. So it's the words of men about God. And because men are fallible, so too are their words fallible, and the Bible is fallible. Anyone who's claiming they believe and follow every word of the Bible has not read it or is counting on you not having read it. The Bible commands you to stone people to death for adultery in Leviticus 20:10. Unless I see them throwing rocks at Mar-a-Lago, I'm going to assume that they don't really follow every part of the Bible. Nor should they, because killing people is wrong.
One of the most egregious parts and phases that we've seen the religious right go through is the attack on poor people, demonizing the poor, which is about as non-Christian as you can get. And this whole idea of the prosperity gospel, boy, that's among the many things that get me riled up, that's the one that just makes me shake my head in disbelief and wonder if those people read the Bible at all.
I think you're right. I mean, Falwell used to do this, talking about the takers and the bums and looking for a handout. And, you know, again, Matthew 25, Jesus says individuals and nations will be judged, heaven or hell, by how they care for the poor. It's pretty much his favorite subject. Like every Jesus talks about the poor a lot. At every live gig, that was like his free bird. He had to do it. You know, that was his thing. And so what we're witnessing now is this time when they're fighting to throw 10 to 20 low-income and disabled people off of Medicaid in this country so the wealthy can get a tax cut. And it's being used as of this recording to finance a very planned government shutdown that's designed to gut the civil service and essentially designed to put thousands of Black people out of jobs. That is what this shutdown is about. The Democrats were handed a position of either consign 20 million souls to early death or showing up at emergency rooms where local taxpayers will foot the bill. Either you sign up for that or you shut down the government and take the blame for it. And this should not be a hard argument to have. The public is already blaming Republicans for it overwhelmingly, and that's only going to get worse. It's another example of how they don't fight. Yeah, they don't fight for the poor, but prosperity gospel is a bit like what Falwell used to say. Now, I don't consider prosperity gospel to be Christian nationalism. It's not racist. They don't preach hatred, you know, Joel Osteen and all that stuff. They also don't preach flooding the church during a hurricane. And they seem to preach, which Jesus commanded us to do. But it's not a hateful movement, but it's still garbage. The prosperity gospel pretty much believes, oh, shucks, God's going to reward you with so much material goods because you're so awesome. You follow his commandments and do the right thing, and God's going to rain down gifts of material wealth on you just for being special. And this is garbage, because when you're messaging this, what you're actually then also saying is hard times and financial problems are probably because you are spiritually deficient.
Right.
There's no way to not mention that. There are parts of the Bible that talk about God rewarding you with material goods, but in terms of Christianity, at no point does Jesus ever promise that you're going to get stuff for following him. Jesus says if you follow him, you got to take up your cross and carry it. He says following his narrow way is not going to be easy. Committing yourself to a life of fighting for the least of these, that's what he means by bringing a sword. He's going to divide families, because standing up for the radical justice he commands means you're going to have to give up something if you're going to walk this path. Jesus was about what you do, not what you get. And that's why prosperity gospel is garbage, victim-blaming theology, dolled up with a smile and quality hair product.
You talk about the fact, and I like to think of it as big tent Jesus, that if you really embrace the teachings of Jesus, you don't hate the Jews, you don't hate the Muslims, you don't hate the atheists, there's room for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you really want to stop the cookout early, just say Jesus commands us to love Palestinians and Israelis equally. And see who gets upset by that comment. There'll be a lot of people who will, and yet it's in the book. It's true. And the fact that that statement makes so many people so uncomfortable shows the corrosive effect of fundamentalism on all our religions and how far we have to go.
And that also includes those who would like to hate the gays and refer to that as an abomination. The same thing with our transgender friends or anybody who lives a lifestyle that those in power deem different than their own.
There is no part of the Bible you can use to say that being gay or transgender is a sin. Again, there is no part of the Bible anybody follows or lives by that justifies discrimination against LGBTQ folks. I go through every one of these passages in the book, Separation of Church and Hate. But I mean, they use Leviticus, shall not lie with a man as with a man, that's an abomination. Leviticus commands you to stone people to death if they work on Saturday. Okay, if you're not trying to kill Major League Baseball and NASCAR, you don't follow Leviticus, which means you don't get to weaponize it to hurt a minority that Jesus commands you to love. I'm really tired of seeing Christianity uses a cloaking device for cruelty. If you want to hate gay people, guess what? You live in a great country that allows you to hate gay people with free speech. Don't ever pretend you give a damn about Jesus if you're going to hate on gay people, because he pretty much forbids any form of homophobia or discrimination in the Sermon on the Mount. And how you treat the lowest of us is how you treat him. He's very specific about this. Homophobes can't stand that. And I go deep in the book about how Jesus actually, I believe, and I think the Bible shows, had no problem with same-sex relationships, and arguably says in Matthew 19 that gay guys are born that way. So the homophobe either has to go back to the Hebrew scriptures, denying that Jesus brought a new covenant, right? Like Leviticus doesn't apply to Christians. You get to have bacon, you idiots. You have bacon, you don't follow Leviticus. It's very simple. You like football, you touch a pigskin, you don't follow Leviticus. You don't get to be a dick to gay people. But then Paul shows up after Jesus, and just like with the misogyny, homophobia is back on the menu. And the worst part is, in much of what Paul's talking about, in Corinthians and in Timothy, he's talking about like Roman temple prostitutes. In Romans, he's talking about how the Romans of old worshipped animal gods. God then gave them over unto natural affections, and men burned with lust for one another. He's more or less saying God got so pissed at these guys, he made them have sex with each other. God made them do it. I believe that's called forced bi in the fetish community, but it's got nothing to do with consensual, loving same-sex relationships in this century. And Paul is pretty much just admitting that there were some guys, some Roman guys who were straight, right? Because if it was unnatural to hook up with guys, then they're not gay guys, they're straight guys hooking up with other guys, which, look at the personal ads, that's not uncommon. And Paul's saying, oh, these guys hooked up with other guys and they were committing idolatry, and I was totally grossed out at the end. It's not saying you get to forget Jesus's commandments and be cruel to gay people. And Paul in Romans commands you to treat the stranger as one of your own. So if you want to hate the gays, you gotta love the immigrants.
And as you say, the purpose of this book is not to make you hate those you disagree with. Maybe not even to understand them, but essentially to let Jesus and the words of Jesus take up the fight for you and be better educated in that verse than they are.
You nailed it. Thank you, Rich. Yeah, it's all about how you can't hate and pretend to follow Jesus at the same time. You don't need to believe in Jesus as a literal person or deity to use his teachings against people who would use his name to justify cruelty and discrimination. I mean, that's the good news about Jesus. You get to drop all this bullshit hate and prejudice. Like, you kind of have to love people, including the ones you don't like ideologically, and the foreigners. It's sort of required when you sign the dotted line and call yourself a Christian. And a lot of atheists know the Bible better than a lot of believers, and it's why many of them are atheists. But again, a lot of atheists still have these kind of folks in their family, and maybe you still love them. And I find if you engage them on what's actually in scripture, maybe they'll appreciate that you took the time to talk to them in terms that they can handle. You probably won't convince them, but you probably will convince their wives and kids and everybody else at the Thanksgiving dinner. I just think you go farther showing your uncle in the scriptures where Jesus wasn't an immigrant-hating homophobe than if you just haul off and call your uncle an immigrant-hating homophobe, because that's going to make you look like a bad guy at Thanksgiving too.
Speaking of family, I love what you said about your parents who left their roles in the church to begin a family. That you said they didn't break a promise to God, they chose love over religion.
Yeah, I grew up, when I was 11, realized what a vow of celibacy was and that I wasn't supposed to be here. So there's my existential Catholic dread for a couple of decades. But my dad always said the same love that brought him into a life of service, of obedience, of poverty, of chastity. My dad was a Franciscan brother who taught Catholic boys history. My mom was a nun who became a nurse and went to work with lepers in Malawi, Africa. And they both always said that the same love that drew them into the service drew them out of the religious life to experience God through love and through having kids and through having a job and paying all the bills. And my dad always said for him it was a very continuous spiritual calling, and I always liked that. I think spirituality is fluid. I think sometimes the most moral thing we can do is change our mind about religion. And Jesus's whole message is about not judgment or superiority, it's about transformation. Jesus got in trouble because he kept saying, go deeper than your religion's laws into love. Go deeper into love than your religion tells you to go. And that's what the transformative power is of love and grace and empathy. And that scares a lot of people. But I think it's amazing that Jesus is as threatening to authoritarian power today as he was 2,000 years ago. And there's a lot that believers and non-believers can learn from that.
By the way, away from the book, I remember it well when it aired, but I revisited your incredible interview with George Harrison a couple of nights ago. And my gosh, that was just so powerful. And arguably, I think the best interview he ever did.
Oh, I don't know about that. There's some really good Dick Cavett interviews with George out there. But it was very special for me. It was a last minute thing. He came in with Ravi Shankar to promote the Chants of India record. And we wound up I was not a very good interviewer. I was very young. I was new at television, and I was not very slick. And I knew if I asked about the Beatles or John Lennon, he would get bored and leave. So I tried to, if I knew if I was like, when are the Traveling Wilburys going to do another record? I knew he wouldn't like it. So I'd asked him about God and death and what happens when you die and meditation and I kept saying the stuff I'd always wanted to say to him, like, why don't you tour? Doesn't playing live give you that same buzz, that same communion with the divine? Like, I feel what they call the presence of the Holy Spirit sometimes when I'm doing stand up and I'm just a clown. Like, don't you get that? And he was like, oh no, the meditation I do, it's 10 times better than playing live. And I think he appreciated that I was just talking to him on spiritual terms. And so we handed him a guitar. He hadn't done a concert in the world in 7 years, hadn't done a concert in America since the 70s. And he played a 4-song set of songs he had never played before. When we started this thing, there was like nobody in the studio. And by the time we wrapped 3.5 hours later, it was like every record executive in New York had like heard about it and came there. And he got diagnosed 2 months later. And that wound up being his final public televised performance. So he gave me a great gift. And I was a terrible interviewer. It was very painful for me to watch for many, many years because I just was so unpolished. But I came to think that's what he liked about it.
Well,
And,
but there was an honesty and a curiosity there that he was clearly impressed with and felt comfortable enough to open up.
he was someone who meant a lot to me. I mean, all the Beatles did, and all the Beatles' solo careers have meant a lot to me for very different and spiritual reasons. And his solo career meant a lot. And as someone who was raised Catholic and then tried to go deeper into his own faith, I always identified a lot with George. And I just think his music is superb. And I think the way his singing improved after the Beatles broke up, and the way his style of guitar playing from the late 70s onward completely changed from what he did with the Beatles. I mean, he's like a different person in the 80s than he was in the 60s. And so I've always gotten a lot out of him spiritually and creatively.
John's
And I still
book,
do.
absolutely. John's book is Separation of Church and Hate, A Sane Person's Guide to Taking Back the Bible from Fundamentalists, Fascists, and Flock-Fleecing Frauds. John, it's great to dig a little deeper and talk with you more today.
Thank you for saying the full title of the book. A lot of hosts are kind of terrified to take all that alliteration on, sir. I respect your bravery. Thank you.